Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the apparent plagiarism by either Melania Trump or her speechwriter with the use of identical passages from a speech by Michelle Obama at the 2008 Democratic Convention, which soon became evident after the keynote speech last night by the wife of the Republican candidate for President Donald Trump. Paul Glastras, a former special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, who wrote over 200 speeches for the president, joins us to discuss how such a clumsy and amateurish act could have happened and who might be responsible. And since the Trump campaign are arrogantly refusing to acknowledge the obvious and nobody has fallen on their sword and taken the fall, could the former Slovenian model who insisted she wrote the speech herself with as little help as possible have lifted the passages from a similar keynote address by the wife of someone Trump has routinely vilified and spewed endless hatred and lies at, the President of the United States, Barack Obama? Then we'll look into the hate speech and personal attacks that dominated last night's Republican convention, most of which were aimed at Hillary Clinton, that animated the crowd and riled them up into chanting, "Lock her up, lock her up." Joining us is Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of White by Law, whose latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We will discuss how racist, hateful attacks against Obama are not even coded at the Republican convention, where, after addressing the crowd, soap opera actor and underwear model Antonio Sabato told ABC News that Obama, quote, is on the other side, the Middle East, the bad guys. We've had a Muslim president for 7.5 years. And joining us now is Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton and wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glastras spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And Paul, it's pretty apparent that some plagiarism went on in terms of the keynote address last night by Melania Trump, where identical passages from a speech by Michelle Obama at the 2008 Democratic Convention clearly and evidently appeared in her keynote speech. But what's amazing since then is that the Trump campaign have arrogantly refused to acknowledge the obvious. Nobody's fallen on their sword and taken the fall. So are we left with the possibility that Melania Trump, who insisted she wrote the speech herself, quote, with as little help as possible, could she have lifted these passages?
Well, you know, it's impossible to know. And it would be absolutely fascinating to be able to do a forensic and see whether it was her who did that, whether it was a research assistant who did it, and she didn't know that that chunk was from Michelle Obama's speech, whether speechwriters did it. It's just really impossible to tell. You can imagine it happening in any number of ways. But somebody was surely responsible. And, you know, it's a definite violation of the code of any self-respecting speechwriter. And it's not surprising that Donald Trump's campaign is, you know, just in the middle of the night, they were more or less admitting that plagiarism had happened. They didn't use the term, but they said, you know, fragments came into the speech that reflected Mrs. Trump's views. But you're right. Now they're in full denial mode, and you know, but that is kind of par for the course. That's Donald Trump's philosophy of this sort of thing. Just never, ever, ever admit error.
Well, his former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, who's now a correspondent at the CNN, has made it clear that it's plagiarism, and he blames Manafort who's the head of the campaign but not the manager of the campaign, he is blaming it. Manafort is blaming it on Hillary Clinton.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, you know, Lewandowski was fired, driven out by Manafort. So whatever he says comes, you know, with an agenda. But you know, I just don't think there's any way to back away from this one. The plagiarism is so obvious. It's virtually an entire paragraph, virtually word for word. Ironically, it's the paragraph talking about honesty and character. and the video is priceless because they've been playing this on a loop on all the cable stations, of Michelle giving that passage and Melania giving that passage, and it's devastating and mortifying. So, you know, there's a lot that happened last night that is arguably more horrible than a bit of plagiarism, including numerous chosen speakers on the podium calling Hillary Clinton a murderer and demanding her imprisonment. But, you know, that sort of thing, we almost kind of expect now. It almost lacks the capacity to outrage because we've heard so much of it. You know, a certain amount of the, you know, dishonesty that we also heard last night of Hillary Clinton being responsible for the, you know, the failure of the military to come and save the son of the mother who spoke last night. You know, all of that has been systematically debunked by numerous, including Republican-led and bipartisan investigations, but it requires some explanation. Whereas, you know, running those two pieces of video side by side, even the most disengaged from politics American seeing that stuff is going to smirk and say, yeah, that was ridiculous. And you can be assured that the press will continue to drive home this plagiarism problem because it's a violation of a fundamental press axiom, a fundamental value of journalists. Journalists care a whole lot more about plagiarism than average Americans, in the same way that men and women in the military care a whole lot more about exaggerating which medals you got and why than average citizens, because it's their life, it's their code of honor. And so the press is not going to let up on this one, where in some ways they've let up on some of these other outrages.
And it's clearly been a career ender for journalists. And again, I'm speaking with Paul Glasgow, who's the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center. And he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, where he wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare to the budget. And before joining the White House, Paul Glasgow spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. No, I think your point about the hate speech, let's call it what it was, hate speech, that you had an African-American grieving man whose son was killed by an undocumented gangbanger, blaming it on Obama and Hillary Clinton, blaming the death of his son. And then you had the widow of, he was actually an internet tech who wasn't even on the State Department's payroll. He was on the Pentagon's payroll. And as you know, Paul, the real activity in Benghazi was the CIA station, and any cover-ups that ever happened and confusions were largely due to the fact that the White House was trying to cover up the CIA annex and its activity and the motives of the reasons why the ambassador himself insisted on going to Benghazi were personal and some that anybody with any integrity would not want to talk about. So the whole thing is really disgraceful. The Republicans know exactly what happened, and they have been milking this one to death, knowing that nobody really wants to point fingers. And there they did it again. So I guess my question to you, Paul, is what does this say about America? Because this was I thought it was a really ugly display, and that includes Giuliani as well.
I think that's right. I think it was both ugly, ill-focused. You know, they're running a primary type red meat convention at a time when they should be running a general election convention that attempts to reach out beyond the hardcore. Not that you don't run a partisan convention. Every convention's partisan. But this is about projecting a brand that can get the widest possible voter base for you in November. And there was almost no attempt to do that. And even if you accept that that's their strategy, it's a doubling, tripling down on the hardcore Trump base, it was not well executed, even on those terms, right? All the Trump people speaking, the Trump kids, the pushing one of the scheduling speakers after Melania, which, you know, should have been, you know, the keynote speaker uses the last one. That's when the confetti comes down, right? That's when you wrap it up. Instead, they put two more speakers after her, and one of them, General Flynn, went on, and the crowd more or less emptied out, and Joni Ernst, the senator from Iowa, who's a kind of rising star on the right, got no airtime. So it was poorly organized, poorly conceived, and ugly.
So then, is it possible then that this is, even though we don't really know about the plagiarism or who was responsible for it, that this is just a part of the general amateurism?
It absolutely could be. Plagiarism happens when editors aren't careful, when there's sloppiness in the organization, and somebody feels they can get away with, or somebody's working at such a breakneck speed that they forget to go back and change the language enough that it's their own. But it's also a function of values, of whether you have a belief in authenticity of facts and documents. And there's a apparent, obvious lack of interest in fidelity and truth when it comes to the written and spoken word, broadly throughout the Trump campaign, which starts at the top.
And we saw the red meat being thrown, and we saw it being lapped up, like hungry dogs in a pound, and the hatred was on display, and the chanting, lock her up, was going on. And I just would like, since you've been in politics a long time, Paul, and have written for a former president over 200 speeches, have you ever seen this in any American convention? The level, we know that the Democrats and the Republicans are opponents. They, in many ways, they used to be colleagues. They used to play tennis together, and their wives became friends, and they had dinners together. I think those days are over. I think there's unquestionably more polarization. I think in many ways Fox News began that kind of polarization, and the other MSNBC imitates it in effect on the other side of the political spectrum. But still, within those parameters, I still have not seen anything quite as venomous as what was spewed out last night.
No, I mean, I've been to three conventions. I've read about a number of others. I'm not old enough to have, you know, gone to the old ones in the good old days, that, you know, where things were rather raucous. I'm sure that there are, you know, you could pull out moments in past conventions where, you know, I'm thinking, you know, 1948, if I have my facts right, when the Dixiecrats, led by Strom Thurmond, broke with the Democratic Party, and I'm sure some things were said there that in even at the time, and certainly in retrospect, were awfully ugly and hateful. But as a strategy, coming from the top of the ticket, and enforced by the leadership of the campaign, and carefully calculated, I don't think we've seen anything remotely like this.
Well,
I mean, you remember Pat Buchanan spoke in, what year was it, 96 perhaps? And the great Molly Ivins quipped that his speech was better in the original German. But, you know, his speech was not nearly as red meaty, if you go back and listen to it, as what we heard last night. It moved in that direction, and it was shocking at the time. But, you know, today, if you actually read that speech or saw that speech, you'd think it was mild by comparison.
And I recall that in many ways it was directed at more liberal Republicans. It was an intramural battle, and that was what happened in 1968 at the Chicago Convention. It was Democrats fighting Democrats, but I'm talking about partisanship in terms of Democrats versus Republicans, and I, as I say, I think they broke new ground last night in lowering the debate to a very poisonous and personal level.
I think you're right, I think this is of a piece with the entire freak show that has been the Republican, electoral race going back to last summer. And just think about the debate moments that are now put together in pro-Hillary ads of some of the things Donald Trump has said about John McCain not being a war hero, about, you know, making fun of Megyn Kelly's menstrual cycle. I mean, it goes on and on and on. This is how the man does business. This is his vocabulary. He's got a ready audience in the Republican Party. They love it. They think that if you can't take it, you can't take a joke, or you're being politically incorrect or whatever. And no one in the none of the adults in the Republican Party can control it, and so it is what it is, and it's unlike anything we've seen.
Well, Paul Glasgow, let's stay in touch, and I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Glasgow, who's the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, where he wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare to the budget. And before joining the White House, Paul Glasgow spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. And we can take a brief station break and be back looking into how hate speech and personal attacks dominated last night's Republican convention.
Come on now, who do you, who do you, who do you, who do you think you are? Bless your soul. You really think you're in control?
Bye.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, who's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his pathbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Glad to join you.
And Ian, our previous guest, I asked him the same question. He's the former speechwriter for President Clinton, Paul Glastras, and he agreed that he had never seen anything like the hatred and personal attacks on display last night at the opening night of the Republican convention. It does seem to be an extraordinary change. I know we've had a lot of polarization in our politics. But Democrats and Republicans never used to hate each other. Congress people and senators, their wives were friends. They played golf together and tennis together. At least they used to. It's not, less and less happening now. But since the Tea Party moved in and took over the Republican Party, there does seem to be a venom that is evident. And here you have a convention coronating the king of the birther movement, the man who has more than anybody propagated this racist canard that President Obama was born in Kenya and doesn't have a valid birth certificate. So how did it strike you last night?
I'd make a distinction between some of the personal vitriol aimed at Hillary Clinton and some of the dog whistling aimed at undocumented immigrants. So if we start with the former, I think that's a reminder that this sort of this sense of personal animosity, this sense of deep hatred, of sort of vitriolic, vehement objection to the other side, that's really a product of the 90s, of the Gingrich contract with America kind of let's impeach the president era. The Clintons were subject to a lot of that in the 90s, and we're seeing it come back. It really is remarkable when you have a speaker saying that the opposing candidate should be imprisoned, and then the crowd erupting in chants, calling for the imprisonment of the presumptive Democratic nominee. That's unheard of, but in this sort of the formal embrace. But I think it resonates with the sort of vitriol, the hatred, the gut level animosity that we saw cultivated by the Republicans as a strategy for animating their base during the 1990s in opposition to Clinton, that continued with the Tea Party, that is intensified with Barack Obama, and frankly, we're in for this sort of level of unreasoning hatred through 2016, and if Clinton wins, then for the next 4 or 8 years.
So have you ever seen anything like this political poison spewed at a white male politician as opposed to an African-American politician and a woman?
Oh, I would say so. I mean, I think if you go back and look at the way in the very personal, ugly terms in which Bill Clinton was attacked, I think that there's a clear antecedent for that. But again, I want to make a distinction between these personal attacks and then the racially coded ones. So what we haven't seen, for example, is Bill Clinton's religion doubted, or Bill Clinton's fundamental loyalty to the country as opposed to a supposed and alleged loyalty to an external enemy. That's new, and that's really connected up with race, and I think we're going to see a lot of gender dog whistling. that's this whole other stream that isn't so much the chance, you know, Hillary for prison in 2016. It's really this stream that says, we can't trust the president. We don't know what's in his heart. He might even be Muslim. He may know more about ISIS than he's letting on. He may be in cahoots with them. And I think that really starts with Sarah Palin in 2008, alleging that Barack Obama pals around with terrorists. It was Marco Rubio's whole campaign theme through 2015 until he exited the race, this sense that Obama's betraying us because of a secret allegiance to Muslims. And look, frankly, it is a way for Trump supporters, for Tea Partiers, for the GOP base to express racial resentment without having to give it an express racial name. Right, so you know the number one indicator of whether someone is a Trump supporter is whether they believe that Barack Obama is a Muslim. That's the single best indicator of whether someone's going to support Donald Trump. This is really about racial resentment, about a sense of the declining position of whites. But it's being expressed not in the language of race, not in the explicit language of, hey, I have problems with a black man in the White House, but instead in the utterly fantastic false idea that Barack Obama is somehow secretly a Muslim and in cahoots with our deepest enemies, right? And so this is the cover that dog whistling, that coded racism gives to these sorts of assaults on Obama, and then the assaults that Trump is deploying when he talks about undocumented immigrants.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, who's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity. Since the publication of his path-breaking book, White by Law, he remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. He's a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, and his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Of course, you didn't have to go far last night to hear about the Muslim innuendo. One of the speakers, the soap opera actor and underwear model Antonio Sabato, told ABC News there in the convention in their booth last night after he spoke that Obama is on the other side, the Middle East, the bad guys. We've had a Muslim president for 7.5 years. It's pretty hard to understand why any rational, reasonable person would believe that. But in terms of coded and dog whistled, the other day after the shooting in Baton Rouge, when President Obama went on television to address the nation, Donald Trump was on Fox shortly thereafter, where he said that, you know, the president's words are okay, but it's his body's language. There's something going on. There's something going on there. The implication clearly being that somehow Obama approves of police officers being shot. Now, this, what do you do to stop this? What is wrong with this country? Why are they accepting this kind of level of discourse? And why is this person the nominee of one of the two major parties of the United States? It's extraordinary, this moment. And I do not notice anywhere in the press that anybody is basically talking about the reality of what's happening, because they seem to be stuck in this convention of false equivalents. And the Democrat said this, the Republican said this. And after all, Trump is the nominee for a major party, so they have to give him all of the respect that he is not due.
I think you're right. I think that is a significant dynamic that many people are treating Donald Trump with kid gloves, because they're saying, well, listen, he's a Republican nominee, and we need to treat him with respect because he's the representative of one of our two major parties. And so I think that is a major dynamic. But I also think that there's this other new dynamic, which is better, but ultimately not very helpful. And that new dynamic is to say, you know what, Donald Trump is a racist. he's a xenophobe, he's a bigot, he's not blowing a dog whistle, he's blowing a bullhorn, this is the siren of a train, and you definitely see this too, right? And this is still a relatively few people in the mainstream media, but more and more, you do have people in the mainstream media saying, hey, what Donald Trump is saying about building a wall to keep out Mexicans or about banning all Muslims, that makes him a racist. And so I think that that's an improvement because we're not pretending anymore that this isn't about race. We're not giving him undue credit. We're not sanitizing what he's saying. But I also think it's not ultimately all that helpful because what it does is it then treats Donald Trump as this weird phenomena, this inexplicable outlier. Here's something new we've never seen before, and since we've never seen it before, we can't put it in context, we can't understand it, and it doesn't really say anything about American society or American politics because it's so new and novel, right? No one would say, hey, you know, closet Klan members running the Republican Party for the last 50 years, and here's another one, Donald Trump. It seems unique. And so I think that this is a significant mistake in analysis. I think it'd be much more helpful to say of Donald Trump, he's engaged in coded racism. He's telling racial narratives. He's manipulating racial fears while pretending to his supporters that he's not doing that. And so he disavows David Duke. He never talks or very rarely talks in color-coded terms. He never says explicitly, I am the candidate of white people, even though that's the obvious subtext of what he's saying. He never uses racial epithets. He's speaking in code in a way that resonates with the racial anxieties, the deep racial anxieties of his supporters, but simultaneously allows them to say to themselves, I'm a decent, moral American, and I oppose racism. And it's important that we understand that this is what Trump is doing, because once we see that, then we can put Trump in context. And then we can say, oh, this has been the Republican strategy since Barry Goldwater in 64, Richard Nixon in 68 and especially 72, Ronald Reagan with all his talk about welfare queens, George H.W. Bush with the Willie Horton ad, George W. Bush and all this talk about a clash of civilizations, Mitt Romney, who spent half his advertising budget falsely trying to tie Barack Obama to welfare reform. This allows us to put Trump in this context and say, this is the sort of essence of conservative politics. Stoke people's racial animosity in coded terms that allows them to deny that they're racist, but builds popular support for the policy preferences of billionaires, or in Donald Trump's case, a billionaire himself. This is dog whistle politics. And here I want to pause and say, because you asked a really good question, how did we get here? We got here in part because liberals have been entirely timid and reticent about addressing the extent to which race is a major structuring factor in our electoral politics and our approach to government in our society. And because liberals, progressives, have not been talking about race, they have essentially ceded the field to conservatives who talk about race all the time in these coded terms when they talk about illegal aliens and gangbangers and inner city crime and contrarywise, the silent majority, the American heartland, the real Americans. Conservatives talk about race constantly, and liberals and progressives have been silent about race. And so now we have a situation in which the Republican Party draws roughly 95% of its support from whites. 98% of its elected officials are white. It has effectively constituted itself as a white man's party. And for the first time, progressive liberals are raising their heads up and saying, whoa, we need to talk about this. What happened? How did this happen? This has been going on for 50 years.
Well, but in light of what you've just said, Ian Haney-Lopez, the fact that, as many commentators and network commentators pointed out last night, that there was more racial diversity on stage than there was in the hall. So that would indicate to me an incredible cynicism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is dog whistle politics. This is an effort to stimulate people's racial anxiety while allowing them to believe that they are not racist. This is what explains the tremendous popular support among the Republican base for people like Herman Cain and Ben Carson. Because both of those guys are sort of walking, well, one of them is just a walking buffoon. The other one is a somnambulant, barely awake. They have almost nothing going for them as candidates except that they are black and that they are mouthing the shibboleth of conservative racial reaction. That's what they're selling. They're saying to whites, hey, you should fear black people. They have a welfare mentality. They have an entitlement mentality. They refuse to take responsibility for themselves. And you can be sure when you agree with everything that I'm saying that you're not racist because I'm a black man saying it. And that's what that is exactly the deep cynicism of the Republican Party. They are willing to use race strategically, cynically, purposefully to sell people these racial fears, these racial narratives that the biggest threat in the life of America and the life of the average American is a person of color, and to do so in blackface if that helps make their case.
But is this a different party from previous? I mean, it seems like a different convention, and I don't recall this before. I don't recall the Republicans. Maybe there was that moment with Pat Buchanan.
Right.
But apart from that, this seems to be a new phenomenon. I'm wondering whether it is the tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party being the Tea Party, that this is a manifestation of Tea Party Republicans, or if the entire party itself has gone over to the dark side.
So I really want to push back against the new phenomenon sort of analysis, because I think we need to understand the continuities.
Right.
What is it that the Republican Party has been doing? For the last 50 years, they have been winning, building popular support for the interests of the plutocrats. They've been winning people over to the business interests, to the sort of the policy preferences of the business element, business side of the Republican Party. How? By saying to them, hey, you should really support us because we're only going to take care of rich people, and we as rich people just want to be richer and we want to control the marketplace and screw the environment and screw the worker? Absolutely not. Instead, they've been saying, you know, you should resent people of color. You should fear them. They're out to get you. And also, that's step one. Step two, and also, you should hate government, because it's government that coddles minorities through welfare. It's government that refuses to control them through lax criminal laws or through lax immigration laws. And because you can't trust government, you should trust instead the marketplace, the job creators, the independent businessmen. That's dog whistle politics. It's cultural politics that says to people, the biggest enemy in your life are other working people. Don't trust government. Trust instead the marketplace. Okay, this is a form of demagogic politics. This is a form of politics that's based upon divide and conquer, on stoking popular fears and anxieties. And that sort of politics is always potentially out of control, out of the control of the people who are wielding it. And so what you've seen in the Republican Party is that dog whistle politics, this sort of cultural politics, it's destroyed the Republican Party itself because they couldn't control it. And each generation of Republicans has seen themselves outflanked by some other firebrand who's further to the right, who's more demagogic, who's more willing to stoke popular fear, anxiety, and even hysteria. And nothing better exemplifies that than the Tea Party phenomena and the way it took out the so-called Republicans in name only, who themselves were more conservative than the predecessors that they had taken out. And now we have Donald Trump, who's even to the right of these people, who plays completely to the sort of demagogic fears, and he has abandoned many stock positions of the business Republicans. you know, much to their dismay, but with no negative impact on his own ability to win votes, because there was never popular support for those policies themselves. It was always the way in which racial animosity was linked to a narrative that said, support the billionaires. Well, now Donald Trump has taken that racial narrative further to the right. But this is the pattern in Republican of politics. Play with demagoguery, play with fire, only to watch yourself get burned the next electoral cycle when somebody comes out who's even more extreme and outrageous than you are.
So at the end of the day then, Ian Haney-Lopez, is this to do with the politics of distraction? In other words, as you pointed out, the oligarchs don't want, and the party itself can't say, look, we only care about rich people, and we're the agents and hirelings of the rich, and we're going to make them even richer, and we're going to con you people into believing that you're going to get some trickle-down crumbs, but you really won't get anything. That's the real agenda. Now, it seems to me that that you can make the case then that the Republican strategists are keeping racism alive, and that's why they love issues like abortion, because it distracts people from their fundamental economic interests. And if people recognized in what they have in common, rather than be divided by racism and racial dog whistle stereotyping, then you would actually have a healthier and wealthier middle class and working class in this country instead of the race to the bottom that it's become.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. So many people are saying, well, how is the Republican Party going to save itself? What's it going to do? How can it reform? And the short answer is it can't reform, because its policies of more and more tax cuts for the very rich, of a corporate control over the regulatory state, of cutting funding for programs that help build a healthy and inclusive society, those are wildly unpopular unless and except when they're sold on the basis of racial resentment or status resentments like gender or purported attacks on Christianity or purported efforts to take people's guns. That's the only way they can sell those policies. On the flip side, among progressives, we must recognize that we cannot bring government back onto the side of people simply by talking about economics. This is not about economics at root. This is about status anxiety, about people's sense of their position in society, about whether they feel respected and included, whether they think that there's a future for them, an honored position for them in our society. And the only way to address that is, and I really want to emphasize this, there's a liberal tendency to say, okay, well, it's really economics that unites us, so all the rest of this stuff is divisive, let's not talk about it. And I want to absolutely foursquare say that's dead wrong. It's precisely that strategy that has made us so vulnerable. We have to talk about gender, procreation, the role of women in society, sexual orientation, transgender rights, race, secularism. We have to talk about all of that so that we can be clear about our values and so that we can help inoculate people against divide and conquer politics. We have to have a simple message that says to people, we can only bring government back on the side of we the people when we're clear that we the people includes all of us of every background, of every color. So when people try and divide us, we need to name those attempted assaults in order to reject them and to say and to insist on the basic shared humanity of all of us. And this is not an evasion of race or of gender. This is a full engagement with it. It is an engagement with it that says racism is everybody's problem in this country, whether you're a person of color or whether you're white. Sexism is a problem for everybody in this country, whether you're a man or a woman. Homophobia, it's a problem not just for people who are gay, lesbian, transgender. It's a problem for people who are straight, because all of these sorts of status anxieties, these group resentments, are being used to pit us against each other and to allow the sort of selfish rich to hijack government and to hijack the market.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Ian Haney-Lopez.
There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. Hero is
you've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Ian Haney-Lopez. And Ian Haney-Lopez, because it occurs to me that the conversation that we're having is such an important one, I wish that it were happening on a broader scale, and I know that you've made a great contribution by the way that you've articulated these complex issues just in the last 20 minutes or so, but also the way that you've done it in your book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Again, in support of Background Briefing and KPFK, you can get this book for a $125 donation at 818-985-5735. How do you think we can, build a movement? I mean, I don't know, for example, that Hillary Clinton is seizing on the issues that we're talking about. She tends to be a sort of status quo politician, and clearly this is the year of the outsider, so she has a tremendous disadvantage. Meanwhile, Trump is so out to lunch and so incompetent and so fraudulent, he may well self-destruct. But do you see, listening to you just a minute ago, I was thinking to myself, my God, I wish Hillary Clinton could articulate what you're saying, and because it really does explode the myths and defuse the entire Republican narrative. It is like pulling the curtain back in The Wizard of Oz, and there you find this frightened old man.
No, I think that that's exactly right. So I recently gave a talk, or recently spoke with W. Kamau Bell. He was doing a podcast for this new set, a new podcast series that he's doing on politics. And we talked about Hillary Clinton and what he should do. And I gave a sort of a mock convention speech that Hillary Clinton should give. And W. Kamau Bell actually, it was a very clever presentation with it. But this is exactly right. Clinton is talking about race in a way that's important, that's new, that Democrats haven't in a long, long time. And I really want to compliment her on that. But she's doing it out of this sense that she needs the support of people of color to win, and she does. And so she's addressing race in terms of issues of concern to people of color. So she's talking about mass incarceration. She's talking about immigration reform. She's talking about voter disenfranchisement. Indeed, I think it's entirely striking that on the first night of the Republican National Convention, Hillary Clinton's giving an address to the NAACP. But what she's not doing is connecting up how race is relevant to whites. And that's what I think she ought to be doing. I think she ought to be saying loudly, racism is a major structuring force in our society. It does special damage to communities of color, but nobody has been spared. It's race over the last 40 or 50 years that has convinced people that they need to throw in their lot with the rich rather than with each other. That's what Donald Trump is trying to do. Let's look at his what he says about Mexicans, what he says about Muslims, what he says about the sitting U.S. president, and let's understand that this is racism as strategy. We as a country are better than that. You people who are supporting Donald Trump need to look to your souls, look, you know, examine your hearts, because we as a country are better than a country that is going to vote along lines of racial fear.
But how,
I don't know. I expect she won't do that.
Right.
But I surely wish she would.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, the message is, look, you're being used. And the problem is that the hatred and contempt and anger at government is on the left and the right. We've seen that from Bernie Sanders, the people who are attracted to his campaign.
Yeah.
So it's pretty hard to defend a bankrupt system and tell people that you're being conned because, you know, they don't believe in the system anymore. That's right.
I think that's right. So the goal of the right is to convince people to give up on government. And now the irony is, with government having been hijacked by conservatives, there's plenty of reason to be deeply frustrated with government. You know, government largely does serve corporate interests right now, and I can totally understand, or government does serve as an occupying force in many minority communities. I can totally understand if people say government, that's the enemy. But I think that that's a huge strategic mistake, because that's actually what the corporations want us to say. The corporate elite, the sort of the Koch brother plutocrats, want us to give up on government because that makes it so much easier for them to take control. And so instead of giving up on government, we need to criticize government. We need to say, hey, government should not serve the interests of the few. It should serve the interests of the many. It's not doing that now. We want government back. And so this isn't a sort of a naive embrace of government as it exists now. This is a political claim, an idealistic, a moral claim on what government should be. And I think it's a basis, go back to your question about mobilization. That's the basis for broad social mobilization. Because just about every issue that people care about, whether you care about the environment or campaign finance reform or immigration or health care or the situation of our cities or infrastructure, just about everything people care about depends upon government serving people. And that's the basic message. Government should serve all of us. Government should serve we the people. That's the government we deserve. That's the government we demand. And it's not the government we have now. And so let's go out there and mobilize. Let's go out there and link arms and demand that government start helping us.
Well, of course, that's always been the extraordinary puzzlement in terms of countering this narrative that began under Ronald Reagan has been so effective, that the government is the enemy, which serves the plutocrats because they own the government. Instead of having social democracy where you pay your taxes and get your government services and the government are responsible stewards of your money, essentially what we have now is a system of right-wing welfare and plutocratic control. And the argument to counter Ronald Reagan's argument about big government should be better government. I mean, I never understood why you can't make a case for better government, because, you know, for all of the ridiculous things we say about the Swedes and the Danes committing suicide, they have 6 weeks vacation, they have full pregnancy leave, they have free university education, they have all the things that Bernie Sanders was talking about and more.
But what they don't have is a racially heterogeneous population, and that's the key difference.
Uh-huh.
So we as a country believed in the idea of activist government that had a duty, and not just a duty, but the ability to create routes of upward mobility. That's the New Deal story. That's the story from the 1930s through the 1960s. But that was a time when the New Deal was structured principally to help whites. And it was structured that way purposefully because the New Deal required, in order to be enacted, it required the support of Democrats from the South. And Southern Democrats insisted that the New Deal be structured in a way that overwhelmingly favored whites. Once we move to the civil rights movement, and once we start to get the demographic change from the immigration law reforms of 1965, that's what creates ground for corporations, for the sort of Koch brother plutocrats, to say to Americans, actually, these government programs that help build the middle class are just giveaways to undeserving minorities. Reject them. Trust instead the marketplace. Right? And so I think, you know, we have to be very clear. The narrative that government is the enemy is sold by Ronald Reagan through racial themes. Why is government the enemy? Because government takes the tax dollars of hardworking whites and wastes them on undeserving minorities. Because government coddles the minority lawbreakers through weak enforcement of criminal law. That was the narrative. It's a racial narrative that convinces people that government is the enemy. And so we cannot get government back. We can't change people's opinion of government until we take on racism and other dog whistle culture war politics like gender and like abortion, like homophobia. Until we take that on and say, you know, government isn't your enemy because it helps other poor people. Government is your friend. Government can be your friend. Government ought to work for you. Because these other people are just like you. They have the same hopes for their children. They experience pain the same way and anxiety the same way you do. We really are all in this together. And I think that's the big challenge, is to convince. This is why the challenge for progressives and liberals is not to come up with the right sort of policy interventions. We know the policy interventions. We had them in this country from the 30s to the 60s. We can look at Europe. We can look at other industrialized, modern industrialized democracies that are doing much better than us in terms of the health of the middle class and a shared prosperity. We know the right policies. What we need to create is, what I and what a number of other people are now calling an inclusion revolution. The sense, a cultural sea change where we really invest at the level of discourse, at the level of civic enterprise, in the idea of creating a shared social contract, a shared commitment to a public sphere, a shared sense that we are all in this together, no matter our color, no matter our background. That's got to be the project of the left, because until we achieve that, we can't pursue these policies that we know will build a healthy democracy and a shared prosperity.
Well, Ian Haney-Lopez, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
And I'm very, very grateful, and I learned a lot. And I thank you again, Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his pathbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.